It's 16 hours GMT. I'm Paul Henley. This is Europe Today from the BBC. Coming up, there's anger in Sweden that the founder of WikiLeaks could have been accused of rape one day and have charges dropped the next.
Here in Sweden, if a woman goes into a police station and says that she was raped, no proof whatsoever is required for the police to go and arrest the man in question.
What really lay behind an outbreak of mass hysteria in a French village almost 60 years ago?
The noise was terrible. I'd prefer to die rather than go through that again.
And the Franco-Spanish artist Manu Chao on the inspiration for his most famous album.
If you're born in Mali, you're not allowed to travel all around the world just because you're born in Mali. It's totally stupid.
That's coming up on Europe Today after the news.
BBC News with Julie Candler. At least seven tourists from Hong Kong have been killed during the hijacking of a bus in the Philippine capital, Manila. The hostage taker, a disgruntled former policeman armed with an assault rifle, was shot and killed by the police. Here's Rachel Harvey.
The nine-hour hijacking is now at an end, but not without bloodshed. After hours of what seemed to be relatively calm negotiations, things took a dramatic and violent turn. The gunman told a local radio station that he was prepared to kill some of his hostages. Shortly afterwards, gunshots were heard. With the drama being broadcast on live television, armed police surrounded the bus, smashing the windows to try to get inside. When they eventually did, they were greeted with another volley of gunfire. They briefly retreated before moving in again with greater confidence. The hijacker had been shot dead by police marksmen.
The UN in Pakistan has described the humanitarian situation caused by the flood disaster as critical. As floodwaters continue to travel south, tens of thousands of people are being displaced each day. Jill McGivering reports from the southern province of Sindh.
A United Nations spokesman told the BBC that the scale of this flood disaster is constantly increasing. It's like running a race, he said, but just when you finally see the finishing line, it moves further away. One of the most urgent needs is for protection from the blazing sun. Previously, the UN said it needed basic shelter for 2 million people. Now the target has increased to 6 million. This week marks a month since the start of Pakistan's massive flood disaster. And as the floodwaters cross Sindh, heading for the sea, the numbers are steadily rising day by day.
A suicide blast in a mosque in Pakistan's tribal northwest has killed at least 20 people, including a former member of parliament. Initial reports suggest the former member of the National Assembly, Maulana Noor Mohammed, was the target of the attack, which took place in the South Waziristan town of Wana, close to the Afghan border. The authorities in South Sudan have accused the central government of breaking their landmark peace agreement by changing the currency in which they're paid oil revenue from US dollars to the local currency. The change deprives the South of its major source of foreign currency, restricting the goods it can import. Peter Martel reports from the southern capital, Juba.
When Sudan ended its two-decades-long war 5 years ago, North and South agreed to share the oil equally. However, while the bulk of the oil lies in the south, the north controls the payments. Now the southern government has said the north has stopped vital foreign currency payments and switched payments to the local Sudanese pound. The southern finance minister, David Denga-Thurboy, has accused the north of deliberately working to weaken the economy of the south, which is due to hold a referendum on its potential full independence in a vote slated for January next year.
World news from the BBC. South Africa's public sector strike that has closed hospitals, schools and courts is continuing in defiance of a government injunction. Demonstrators are still dancing and singing at the gates of the hospitals. Trade union leaders say they've instructed their members to continue striking but to avoid doing anything illegal. A traffic jam stretching more than 100 kilometres on the expressway linking the Chinese capital with Inner Mongolia has now lasted 9 days. Martin Patience in Beijing has the details.
Even in a country used to congestion, this is extraordinary. A mammoth tailback involving hundreds of vehicles and gridlock for more than a week. The traffic jam 200 kilometres northwest of Beijing appears to have been caused by roadworks and broken down vehicles. But despite the obvious frustration of going nowhere, some are playing chess and cards, and locals have set up temporary stalls to sell food and drink.
Microbes taken from a cliff on the southern coast of England have survived a year and a half in outer space. The bacteria were living inside a rock which was bolted to the outside of the International Space Station in 2008. They were the only organisms still alive when the spacecraft returned. Professor Charles Coquel of Britain's Open University was involved in the research.
We think that this microbe could be used in life support systems to sustain people on the Moon and Mars, where there is no oxygen and you have to produce it by microbes in order to live on the surface of those planetary bodies.
Rescue workers at a mine in northern Chile say they will shortly be able to send the first supplies of water to 33 miners who've been trapped underground for more than 2 weeks. Mining experts have been securing a narrow tube, which is at the moment the miner's only lifeline. Meanwhile, a specialised drill is on its way to dig a new shaft to pull the miners to safety. BBC News.
You're listening to the BBC World Service. I'm Paul Henley. Welcome to Europe Today. First, there's been criticism of a decision by a Swedish prosecutor at the weekend to issue an arrest warrant for rape against the founder of WikiLeaks, Julian Assange, an arrest warrant that was then withdrawn the following day. The former computer hacker described the allegations made against him as shocking and suggested that somebody might have been hiding behind them. Millions of people heard the claims, which developed much like this on Saturday.
State prosecutors in Sweden have confirmed to the BBC that they have issued an arrest warrant for Julian Assange on two counts. He is suspected of rape and sexual assault.
Prosecutors in Stockholm initially issued an arrest warrant for rape, but Julian Assange responded by denying the accusations against him, calling them baseless and deeply disturbing. Then the chief prosecutor, Eva Finne, said the arrest warrant for rape had been dropped, as Mr. Assange was no longer a suspect for that offence.
Well, a small Swedish justice watchdog group called RO, the Organisation for the Protection of the Legal Rights of the Everyday Citizen, filed a complaint on Sunday against the on-call prosecutor to the Ombudsman of Justice in Sweden, an office that investigates wrongdoing by public authorities. William Butt, who's spokesman for the organisation, told Europe Today there was a fundamental problem with the Swedish legal system.
What people outside Sweden don't know about Swedish domestic affairs is that here in Sweden, if a woman goes into a police station and says that she was raped, no proof whatsoever is required for the police to go and arrest the man in question. We have very flimsy laws when it comes to arresting people for this kind of crime. This is happening almost every week. Sweden is the one country in the world that has the highest rate of rape lawsuits. And this is happening very constantly. In fact, a few years ago, in 2006, our Chancellor of Justice, Mr. Göran Lambertz, who is now Supreme Court judge, issued a report in which he told us and the world about a dozen men who had been wrongfully imprisoned for rapes they didn't commit. I mean, it's happening all the time. So nobody is surprised here. It's only all of you outside Sweden who are surprised, because to you it sounds incredible. To us it's everyday, you know, occurrence. This should never happen again, that a prosecutor sitting alone in a little office on a Saturday morning should not be allowed to make a decision like this. We think that at least two or three prosecutors should get together and make a decision when it comes to something so serious as putting a person behind bars.
That's William Butt from the Swedish human rights watchdog RO. I've been speaking to Oisin Cantwell, a reporter for Aftonbladet, which is the newspaper that first broke the news of the rape charges against Julian Assange that were then retracted. I asked him what he knew about the women who'd made the claims.
They're young. They're between 25 and 30, both of them. They live in the Stockholm area, and apparently they both have met Mr. Assange.
You spoke to Julian Assange at the weekend. What did he tell you?
Well, he said that it was difficult for him to answer any questions about these women, because in the media they were anonymized. Their names or their pictures weren't printed, so he couldn't really answer any questions about if he had met them or not.
But he absolutely dismissed the idea that he'd been involved in rape.
Oh yeah. He says he has done nothing illegal at all.
And what did he tell you about any theories that he might have about where these claims had come from and who was making them and what the aim of them was?
Well, he said he had no proof, but that intelligence sources in Australia lately has warned him that there would be smear campaigns going on.
Do you believe that?
No, not really. I think this whole issue is very strange and it's very confusing, but I don't think that, for instance, the Pentagon or the CIA or any other organization has anything to do with this.
He's a very high-profile figure in Sweden, isn't he? And he's not short of supporters there, I understand.
Oh, no, he's very popular, but at the same time, of course, he's controversial in Sweden as in the rest of the world.
How will this impact, do you think, on him and on WikiLeaks?
Well, Mr. Assange himself told me that, of course, this is a problem for the organization, and I believe he's right. Even if there's no suspicion of rape any longer, as he said himself, there's been headlines all over the world about this issue, and of course people that don't like WikiLeaks will use this against him.
Obviously people outside Sweden won't be familiar with the justice system there, but have you come across many cases of this kind where a charge is put out there in the public domain and then immediately retracted?
No, this is very, very... Of course it happens that the proof situation changes and people will be released, but I can't remember anything like justice. It's very strange that they change their mind so fast.
Oisin Cantwell from Aftonbladet newspaper in Sweden. Well, whatever the truth about the allegations against Julian Assange, they went all over the world within hours of being made. David Lee is the investigations editor of The Guardian newspaper in London, and he joins me now. David, given the worldwide prominence of Julian Assange, thanks to the secret documents that he made public about the Afghan war, how has media coverage of these events played out across the world?
Well, it's very ironic that Julian Assange, who's the founder of an organization dedicated to worldwide unchecked leaking, should be the victim of worldwide unchecked leaking, because what happened was, when this story was leaked, presumably from police sources to a Swedish tabloid, within hours there were literally more than a million hits on Google and hundreds of stories and articles about it, and the whole thing whizzed around the world before it had a chance to be retracted, as it was several hours later.
He has many supporters across the world and many opponents as well, and is an obvious target, some would say, of some kind of smear campaign.
There's absolutely no evidence, as far as we're concerned, that a smear campaign is going on. Well, we've looked into it and we've talked to the people who were involved in this saga last week. It's very attractive to think that somebody who defies the United States government in the way that Assange did is going to be the victim of a smear campaign. But as far as I can see, whatever the truth of this, a young woman went and complained she'd been mistreated. And that's what's at the back of it. And she doesn't appear to be in the employ of the Pentagon.
Okay. And is there a sense in which, do you think, this whole thing could help Mr. Assange's public image?
Well, it certainly raised his profile even higher than it was. I mean, when we published his so-called Afghan war logs, 90,000 of them, it raised his profile and the profile of WikiLeaks quite high. This has now raised it even higher. But do you want to be notorious for being the subject of rape allegations? I don't think so.
How surprised are you by what's happened?
Well, nothing surprises me. Julian Assange is an unusual person. WikiLeaks is an unusual organization. And what they're doing is at the cutting edge of what it's possible to do in the Internet age. So in a way, he's ridden the tiger of the Internet age, if you like, and maybe the tiger's turned around and bit him now.
What do you think he feels about that?
I should think he feels very cross indeed.
Right. Thank you very much for joining us. That's David Lee, investigations editor of The Guardian newspaper in London. This is The World Service. This is Europe Today. Coming up later in the programme, how members of the Italian mafia are devising even more ingenious ways of communicating with their bosses in prison.
In soccer games, the public often shows banners with sports or inscriptions and things. But among them, there are sometimes some very cryptical messages. Hello, Peter, everything is okay. And these are thought to be hidden message for the bosses who see this broadcast on the network.
That's all coming up later in the programme. Now, on the 16th of August 1951, a mysterious outbreak of what was described as mass hysteria erupted in the small town of Pont-Saint-Esprit in the southeast of France. Hundreds of people suddenly fell violently ill. Many suffered wild hallucinations of being burnt by fire or attacked by snakes. Some had to be put in straitjackets after they tried to jump through open windows. Five people died and dozens more were hospitalised for weeks. Until recently, the event, known in France as le pain maudit, or the cursed bread, has been blamed on flour contaminated by a naturally occurring but highly poisonous fungus. The BBC has been investigating claims that it was really the result of an experiment using the drug LSD carried out secretly by America's Central Intelligence Agency. Mike Thompson reports.
In mid-August 1951, postman Léon Armounier was doing his rounds when he was suddenly overwhelmed by nausea and wild hallucinations.
It was terrible. I had the sensation of shrinking and shrinking, and the fire and the serpents coiling around my arms, and I couldn't do anything about it because I was in a straitjacket.
Léon, now 86, shared a room in hospital with three teenagers who'd been chained to their beds to keep them under control.
Some of my friends tried to get out of the window of the hospital in Pont-Saint-Esprit. They were thrashing wildly, the others, screaming, and the sound of the metal beds and the jumping up and down. The noise was terrible. I'd prefer to die rather than go through that again.
Over the coming days, dozens of other people in the town fell prey to similar symptoms. Doctors at the time concluded that bread at one of the town's bakeries had become contaminated by ergot, a poisonous fungus that occurs naturally on rye. That view remained largely unchallenged until American investigative journalist Hank Alberelli came across the following CIA document.
The White House, Washington. M. Re Pont Saint-Esprit and F. Olson files. Hand carry to Belin. Tell him to see to it that these are buried.
F. Olson is Frank Olson, a CIA scientist who at the time led research for the agency into the drug LSD, the only source of which came from a private laboratory just a few hundred kilometres away from Pont Saint-Esprit. Belin was executive director of the Rockefeller Commission, created to investigate abuses carried out worldwide by the CIA. Arborelli says he also found a top-secret report issued in 1949 by the research director of the Edgewood Arsenal, where many US government LSD experiments were carried out. Its message, he says, was clear.
The Army should do everything possible to launch field experiments whereby they could assess the effectiveness of chemicals, including LSD, in displacing the use of modern warfare as we know it with guns and bombs.
The incident in Pont-Saint-Esprit coincided with the Korean conflict and the escalation of the Cold War, and many other armies, including Britain's, were experimenting with LSD.
After 35 minutes, one of the radio operators had become incapable of using his set, and the efficiency of the rocket launcher team was also very impaired.
Using LSD as a possible weapon of war was soon dropped by armies everywhere. And looking back, it's not hard to see why.
1 hour and 10 minutes after taking the drug, with one man climbing a tree to feed the birds, the troop commander gave up, admitting that he could no longer control himself or his men. He himself then relapsed into laughter.
The new LSD theory has its critics, who claim the symptoms suffered in Pont-Saint-Esprit don't quite fit the drug, and that it wouldn't have survived the fierce temperatures of a baker's oven. But some are now calling for a full French government inquiry into what happened. What, I asked 86-year-old Léon Armounier, would he do if such an inquiry was to conclude that LSD, planted by the CIA, had been responsible for what happened to him and so many others in Pont-Saint-Esprit?
Of course, you'd have to be sure. But if I knew who it was, who put me through all that, I'd shoot them.
That's the former postman of Pont Saint-Esprit in France, ending that report by Mike Thompson. Now, Germany should not close down its nuclear power stations and should plan on having them around for a long time yet, in fact. Who says that? Well, a list of 40 leading companies, which have placed an open letter in the German national press addressed to the Chancellor Angela Merkel. Our business reporter Tim Jenkins is here. Tim, this is about Germany previously having promised to do away with nuclear power altogether, right?
Yeah, that's right. About 10 years ago, the then governing coalition decided they would, you know, put all of these power stations, mothball them, close them down entirely by 2022. Well, now they've introduced a new tax on nuclear fuel rods, which the government says it will use to fund a move into greener alternatives to electricity generation. Thing is, no details emerged on how this will all work, and specifically, Angela Merkel has decided to extend the life of those nuclear power stations now, but not to the wish, not to the demands of the nuclear power generating companies. And those companies are saying, hold on, we need the electricity that's generated. So no surprise to see some of the power companies mentioned in this open letter this morning. E.ON, Vattenfall is their RWE. But also what's interesting, Paul, is that Germany's biggest users of electric power have signed up to. Massive firms like BASF or Deutsche Bank, even the manager of the German national football team is worried about where their power is going to come from in the future.
And what's their argument?
Well, if you're a power company, you're going to be worried about the loss of the 2.3 billion euros that you're going to be taxed for those nuclear fuel rods. If you're one of their customers, you're going to be worried about the price of electricity going up, you know, as the companies find some other way to boost their profit line and keep their costs down. That's what these guys are arguing anyway. We approached a whole series of these companies, Paul, to expand on that, mostly because it's the summer. It's hard to get hold of these guys, so nobody was available to talk to us today. One supermarket chain spokesman did talk to us off the record and said that, listen, until there's sufficient green energy alternatives which can replace the output of nuclear power plants, they're completely worried about fuel security and their future fuel bills.
And all of this puts the government under pressure. They want to implement this next month, don't they?
They do. And looks like a bit of a stalemate, to be honest with you, at the moment, with the Chancellor herself wondering what options she has.
We have proposed a tax, and so long as there is no other proposal on the table, the tax remains. We'll have more clarity on this issue once we've reached a consensus on the energy issue at the end of September. But at the moment, the tax is the only option available to me. We're open to other suggestions from the energy industry, but at the moment, I can't see what they might be.
Chancellor Merkel speaking on the German TV station ZDF, though.
It's quite unusual for German business people to do such a public lobbying this.
They don't like doing it like this. They prefer to do it all behind the scenes. But, you know, maybe it's disquiet about energy policy. Maybe it's disquiet about economic policy generally, Paul, really. Angela Merkel postponed some tax cuts, which the business community was looking forward to. What is on the horizon is a big cut in public spending soon. So a lot of executives are worrying about, you know, this choking off spending and buying at home. Citigroup's Jürgen Michels points out if other trading partners of Germany slow down spending too, Germany's going to suffer, and so will its near neighbours.
The fiscal tightening, what is coming up there, is massive, and it will not be enough, the demand from Germany, to prevent deep recessions in the periphery countries. But we shall not forget, last year, Germany was one of the economies in the euro area that had the largest fall in economic activity, and that was led by the collapse in exports.
Jürgen Michels there, Paul.
Thank you very much, Tim. Now, only three countries in the world, the Soviet Union, the United States and China, have ever sent a human being into space. Two amateur astronauts from Copenhagen aim to make Denmark the fourth. They might be a while off their goal yet, but given their modest budget of €50,000, things are pretty far advanced. Next week, Copenhagen Suborbitals plan to launch a rocket with room for a person on board. In this case, it'll just be a crash test dummy, for now, from the Baltic Sea. Should NASA feel worried? Peter Madsen is one of the two people behind the project and joins me now live from Copenhagen. Peter, what qualifies you potentially to be Denmark's first astronaut?
Well, I used to be Denmark's first amateur submariner, so why not go high instead of low?
Is the technology that similar?
Actually, it's more similar than one would assume. When you're in a submarine, you are cut away from Earth atmosphere and you are in a 3D environment, in a weightless environment potentially. So there are some similarities, yes.
So tell us about your rocket. How will it work exactly? Without being too technical, obviously.
I'll try. Well, it's really very simple. It's much like a booster, which is like the engine providing the thrust, connected to a capsule, a tiny capsule with a human on board. And we lit the booster. It burns for about a minute, and then we separate the capsule, and it flies outside the Earth atmosphere, becomes weightless, and re-enters the Earth atmosphere because of gravity, and is then landed at sea in parachutes.
And at a budget of 50,000 euros, you have the resources, do you, potentially, to get a man back alive? This part of the capsule that will contain the astronaut will return safely, you think?
Not entirely. What we're doing now is...
Well, I hope so, in your case, because you're going to be the man in it.
Definitely, but step by step, the first flight here is a test of a boilerplate version of the capsule. So we are flying a rocket of the full size and a capsule of the full size, but we are flying it to much less altitude, just 20 kilometers up, and we are landing it at sea to test all the systems that will be needed when we fly human beings later on.
Is it a daft question to ask why you want to do this?
Because it's possible.
And affordable, obviously.
Affordable because we work in a very different way than the professionals. Clearly, professionals use enormous budgets to get things into space, and when we include humans, it becomes incredibly expensive, and we can't do that, so we have to think different. And thinking different is the road ahead, I believe, in spaceflight, because what we do now is just too expensive. Well, so we've tried to redesign the ways to do things.
Peter, you've whetted our appetites here on Europe Today. We're going to watch your mission with interest, and good luck with it. Thank you for coming on the programme. Peter Madsen from the company Copenhagen Suborbitals. Now, let's look at the sports news. English football clubs have made the most money from last season's Champions League, even though they failed to progress past the quarterfinals. Our sports reporter John Myers has been looking at the figures. How much money is at stake here, John?
We're talking big bucks, Paul. The four English clubs earned together 140 million euros. They were followed by the four Italian clubs, including the champions Inter Milan, who received 116 million. And the four Spanish sides, including the beaten finalist Barcelona, earned a combined total of just 105 million euros. On the individual breakdown, Inter came out on top with 48.7 million euros, but Man United knocked out in the quarterfinals, a close second. They made 45.8 million.
I suppose this means that TV revenue is becoming more important than prize money.
Absolutely. The financial success of the four English clubs reflects a 25% increase in the value of TV rights deals signed with the commercial broadcasters ITV and Sky. It also drives home the importance of qualifying for this competition. For example, Liverpool's failure to finish in the top four last season will have put a serious hole in their finances. Success in the Europa League is likely to earn them just a fraction of what they earned last season. That might well be one of the reasons why their current owners have put the club up for sale.
On a similar theme, there's good news today for Italy's top flight clubs, following a new TV rights deal.
Yep, Serie A set to return to profit this season following a 20% rise in income from broadcasters. One sports consultancy predicts clubs will now post an average profit of 400,000 euros in Italy compared to losses of 8.3 million last year. So it really does show us that the money from the TV viewers is becoming more important than the money paid for by fans entering into the stadium.
Thank you very much, John Myers, with the latest sports news. You're listening to the BBC. We're broadcasting live from Bush House in London. This is the World Service. Stay tuned.
If you're new to the BBC World Service and are trying to work out what's on when, we've got a neat little way to help you. Go to bbcworldservice.com and click How and When to Listen.